Greg Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. You need to have pencil and paper a little bit later in this hour. Thanks to Sheila Samples again from Op-Ed News. Something important that you need to know, how to delete your Google browsing history before the new policy goes into effect. And it's coming the first. Boy, every time you turn around, it's something else, right? Huh? So stick around. This hour is sponsored by Bill in Paso Robles, California. A frequent contributor, email contributor. He writes a lot to the program. Thanks, Bill. His message, Mike and Kathy, what you deliver night after night is immeasurable and priceless. Deepest thanks, Bill in Paso Robles, California. Thank you very much, Bill. It's very kind. Appreciate it. I have to mention it. Davy Jones of the Monkees died today, age of 66. Apparently a heart attack at his home this morning. Taken to the hospital, pronounced dead. Peter Tork, his Monkees bandmate, released the following statement via Facebook. Quote, it is with great sadness that I reflect on the sudden passing of my longtime friend and fellow adventurer, David Jones. His talent will be much missed. His gifts will be with us always. My deepest sympathy to Jessica and the rest of his family. Adios to the Manchester Cowboy. Peace and love, Peter T. Something, just a little trivia thing that you may or may not know. Davy Jones, of course, was... he had a professional acting career when he was a kid, and... when he was 18 years old, he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show to perform as part of the musical Oliver. That happened to be the same episode of the Ed Sullivan Show as the Beatles' legendary debut concert in this country. Davy Jones, you know, say what you like about that music. It... And I realize Bobby Hart and who was the other one? Bobby Hart and I forget the other songwriter. They wrote all the music. I don't think the Monkees at the beginning ever wrote anything. But in the late, mid to late 60s, they produced a sound that is definitely from that era. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. Maybe you did too. And you just won't admit it, right? London's Occupy protesters were moved out in a midnight operation. About 50 tents moved. The High Court in London last week had allowed or ordered the eviction. And St. Paul's Cathedral, where the Occupy protesters had pretty much encamped around that area, St. Paul, a spokesman for St. Paul's Cathedral, called the tearing down of the tents and the removal of these Occupy protesters a sad day for the church. Indeed. About 20 arrests were made. The land on which the tents were put up were owned by the City of London Corporation. They do things a little bit differently. Their bailiffs employed by the civic authority got the tents removed in an hour-long operation. That's how they do it. They don't send out deputies or sheriffs or... They send bailiffs. The tents, of course, had come up in October, inspired by the same movement in this country against corporate greed and economic inequality. The City of London Corporation said it regretted, their word, that it had become necessary to evict the protesters. Regretted? And the eviction followed the High Court ruling last week that removing the camp was, quote, lawful and justified, end quote. George Barta, one of the five protesters who had appealed against the High Court's decision, was quoted by the BBC as saying, quote, it's not the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning. So, Occupy London protesters forcibly removed from their site, as is happening in this country a lot. Thank you. We have a report card from Kate Petrini that I want to share with you here a little bit later. She gave her U.S. history students an assignment based on Newt Gingrich's remarks regarding children working as janitors. And she sent me some of the replies from the kids in her class. She teaches, of course, at a parochial school in San Francisco. I'll share that with you a little bit later. A new study, rich people are more likely to lie and cheat. Wow, do you think they got rich, right? According to CNBC, there's a new study by the University of California, Berkeley, pretty much confirming what Occupy protesters have been saying, that the ethics of the rich are just crap, garbage. They lie, they cheat, they steal, they do anything necessary to continue to build up their pile of green pieces of paper. According to the study, upper class people are more likely to lie, cheat, endorse unethical workplace behavior, and even to cut others off when driving. According to the study, they're just total bastards, that's all. Volunteers who took part in the study reported their social class using the MacArthur scale of subjective socioeconomic status and filled out surveys revealing their attitudes about behavior and greed. Drivers from the upper class are four times as likely as other drivers to cut off other vehicles at a busy four-way intersection, three times more likely to cut off a pedestrian. And the chances of their agreeing with the old Gordon Gekko maxim from the movie Wall Street that greed is good are much higher. The study also showed that the super rich are more likely to literally take candy from a baby. Participants were in a laboratory with a jar of candy kept for visiting children and were offered the jar, whereupon the wealthier members of the study took twice as many. They were also more likely to deceive job candidates who they were recruiting for a job which would shortly be eliminated. Nice, huh? A doctoral student in psychology at UC Berkeley, lead author of the paper, said in a statement, quote, "The increased unethical tendencies of upper-class individuals are driven in part by their more favorable attitudes toward greed." He went on to say, "Mrump, these findings have very clear implications for how increased wealth and status in society shapes patterns of ethical behavior and suggests that the different social classes of social values among the haves and have-nots help drive these tendencies." Boo! Well, that's certainly a news flash, isn't it? That the rich are different from you and me. This guy obviously listens to Glenn Beck's radio program. Adrian Klein, he's 43 years old from Brighton, Colorado. He's an embalmer, and he's accused of stealing gold teeth from corpses and then pawning them for cash. According to Longmont, Colorado newspaper, pawnbrokers in that city noticed that the Beck fan, Adrian Klein, was frequently bringing in dental gold and thought it was creepy and weird. You see, prior to embalming, Klein, while he's listening to Glenn Beck, is suspected of removing gold crowns from the bodies, and then after cremation, Klein is suspected of removing dental gold from the remains. He would then allegedly take the gold to pawn shops to sell while he whistles along with Glenn Beck. A Boulder grand jury indicted Klein on suspicion of 8 counts of providing false information to a pawnbroker and 2 counts of providing false information to a second-hand dealer, and 3 counts of being a total ass and listening to Glenn Beck while he rips the teeth out of corpses. Wow. You know, Glenn Beck listeners will stop at nothing. Just nothing. I mean, it's incredible. Police say that from May through November of 2011, Klein made 17 sales at various locations of other people's teeth, corpses' teeth, that added up to nearly $4,000. We'll be right back.
Oh, I she sings. The 6 o'clock alarm would never ring. But it rings, and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold, and it stings.
Bubblegum, right? But and thanks to Barb, it was Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart who wrote Monkey Music. Davy Jones died today, age 66, of a heart attack. A growing number of Americans can't find or can't afford food. Now, Prairie 2, whom we'll hear from a little bit later tonight with this report, has been warning about this for a long time. But it was at Huffington Post. The report comes to Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit research group. And according to their findings, more Americans said they struggled to buy food in 2011 than in any year since the financial crisis. About 19% of people, almost one out of every five, told the Gallup pollsters who took this survey that they couldn't always afford to feed everyone in their family in 2011. Now, you can make the assumption that number got smaller, wrapped up with the national unemployment rate falling for several consecutive months, as it has here. But actually, the reverse has proved true. The number of people who said they couldn't afford food just keeps rising. And the findings from the Food Research and Action Center highlight what many people already know. The economic recovery, in theory, now more than 2 years old, has done little to keep millions of Americans out of poverty. And as Huffington Post reports it, incomes for many haven't kept pace with the cost of living. And for a large part of the country, things today are as bad as ever, or worse. 46 million Americans live below the poverty line as of 2010, a record number, according to the Census Bureau. And that's not as high as some other estimates have put it. And as HuffPo puts it, take a further step back, and the situation appears even more dire. About 45% of people in the U.S. have reported not being able to cover their basic living expenses, including food, shelter, and transportation, according to the group Wider Opportunities for Women. Now, the official poverty rate in this country is about 15%, but over two-fifths, 40% of Americans, have so little saved that one financial emergency is all it would take to put them in poverty. That's according to the Corporation for Enterprise Development. As for widespread hunger of the kind recorded by the study, research shows that the entire country ends up paying one way or another. Well, the people who can't afford food are obviously suffering the worst. The social costs incurred from the money spent to keep food pantries open to the lifelong diminished earning power of impoverished children. Well, if you got to put a dollar or figure on it, it comes to about $167 billion a year, or $542 for every man, woman, and country, or a child in the country. Land of the free, land of opportunity, home of the brave, the greatest country on earth. Hey, hey, hey. The mythology just continues, doesn't it? Huh? It just continues. I mean, every day if you have a job, you get up, go to work. If you have to ride the expressways, the freeways, interstates in your part of the country, man, it's just chock-a-block with cars. How could anything be going wrong? There's nothing going wrong. How could anything be going wrong with all the cars on the expressway? We're all going to work, right? Right? One of the mysteries of the universe, right? Okay, stick around. When we come back, it's going to be either a Prairie 2 or Cape Petrini. We'll have a conference here during the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I
tried. For the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Bill in Paso Robles, California. Thanks, Bill. His message, Mike and Kathy, we deliver night after night, is immeasurable and priceless. Deepest thanks, Bill in Paso Robles. That's very kind. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for the sponsorship. Kate Petrini is a school teacher in San Francisco. She's our education affairs correspondent. She sends this. Hi, Mike. Last week, I gave my U.S. history students the following assignment based on Newt Gingrich's remarks regarding children working as janitors. Here's the assignment. Quote, you say to somebody, you shouldn't go to work before you're 14 or 16 years of age. Fine, you're totally poor. You're in a school that is failing with a teacher that is failing. I've tried for years to have a very simple model. Most of these schools ought to get rid of the unionized janitors, have one master janitor, and pay local students to take care of the school. The kids would actually do work. They would have cash. They would have pride in the school. They'd begin the process of rising. Really poor children in really poor neighborhoods have no habits of working and have nobody around them who works, so they have no habit of showing up on Monday. End quote. Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the U.S. House and current presidential candidate. After watching the video clip and reading Mr. Gingrich's comments, students write a 1-2 paragraph thoughtful letter to him in which you respond to his proposal that children work as janitors. Use specific information from our unit on industrialism and the Gilded Age to back up your arguments. All right, that was Kay's assignment. Here are some excerpts from her students' letters. And she adds, I'm proud of them. Here's the first one. Your proposal that children should work as janitors was very ignorant and shocking. Don't you know anything about the history of industrialism and the Gilded Age? Impoverished children and their families had to work in terribly dangerous, low-paying jobs for extremely long hours. They had to live in tenements where there was squalor, overcrowding, disease, and no sanitation. So your comments about how, quote, really poor children in really poor neighborhoods have no habits of working and nobody around to make them around them who works, end quote, could not be further from the truth. Please do your research before you make statements to the public, Mr. Gingrich. Next one. How many hours would the students work? Would they receive breaks? Would they get minimum wage? Is there coverage or protection if the child gets injured on the job? I hope that nothing would happen like what happened in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Next. I believe your proposal was wrong and made no sense. You said, quote, really poor children have nobody around them who works, end quote. However, just because you are poor does not mean you don't know how, you don't know anybody who works. Not everyone who is poor is out of work. They could be working but just receiving a low income. Next. I'm not sure you actually know what poor families experience. I disagree with you because many people that came to the United States at the turn of the last century all worked to make a living and support their families. Many of the children were not able to go to school because they had to help. However, once the progressives, capital P, became involved and saw the condition of the places where the kids worked, they took action. The progressives made it possible for children to go to school. And the next. You want to get rid of unionized janitors. Are you aware that unions benefit workers? They're extremely important because they help if you get sick or injured or unemployed. You need to be grateful for the things you have and help those who do not have the blessings you do, Mr. Gingrich. And the next. Obviously, you do not realize that one of the best things that President FDR ever did was pass the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. What type of future can a working child have? Take a look at the pictures of children who worked during the industrialism and the Gilded Age, and you will see how these children's childhoods were taken from them. Next. Back in the day, the working conditions of children were horrifying. Some examples are that they were not paid a lot, they could not use the bathrooms while they worked, and if they got injured, they were either fired or had to keep working with their injured body part. Is this really what you want for the children of our future? Next. Poor children already go through so much stress, and to make them work more than they already do is a horrible idea. Going to school provides them a break from their difficult and stressful lives. It's a place where they can feel safe and where they pursue their hopes of a better future. Poor children need education to advance themselves. They don't need more work. And then Kay adds, at the end of this reading, these amazing letters makes me think that maybe, just maybe, what I do for a living matters, at least today. Kay. And you can read more about this. Go to her website, kaysreportcard.com, kaysreportcard.com. And a P.S. Mike, this week at school, I'm teaching a class on foreign films. This is part of a program of alternative classes that we do every other year. Monday's selection was an outstanding film entitled Paradise Now, which follows two young men on the West Bank after they are recruited to be suicide bombers. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It was necessary for me to give my class an introduction to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict before the movie because their knowledge of the subject was almost non-existent. Mike, you often talk about the line that the American government toes in dealing with Israel and how the media parrot that strictly pro-Israel viewpoint. After Monday's lesson, it was clear to me that the rules, quote-quote, which have been established by those two entities have had a profound effect on me. As I led the classroom discussion, I found myself anxious, overly cautious, and very uncomfortable. I was very careful to not cross any line for fear that I would have angry parents to deal with, if you know what I mean. Ultimately, I did the best I could, and I believe the kids now have a basic understanding of the intractable Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But when I think about how I felt teaching the Middle Eastern material versus giving students the background of pre-Castro Cuba in preparation for yesterday's film, Chico and Rita, there's just no comparison. Just another indication of how strongly we Americans have been indoctrinated. Okay. Yeah, I get that feeling every time I bring up the Palestinian-Israeli issue for the past quarter century, even going back to the first Intifada in the early 80s when I was working at the very conservative Cox Communications-owned radio station WSB here in Atlanta, a 50,000-watt unrestricted channel that blasted out over about 35 states. And as an explorer I don't think I was a truth seeker at the time, more of an explorer going into the territory I had no idea about, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because I had been, you know, I'd been inculcated with pretty much the same thing that most Americans had. I can remember I was in Raleigh, North Carolina during the 1967 war. And just in the Middle East, and just absolutely cheering on the Israelis, Moshe Dayan and the Israeli high command, who fought against four different Arab armies and beat them. And I can remember I had a lot of Jewish friends, still do, and just being in a real celebratory mood when it was apparent that Israel was just stomping the hell out of the enemies that surrounded their tiny little country. And it took about 15 or 20 years for me to once again revisit that topic. And when I did, in talking with American Jews, Palestinian Americans, people who had lived on kibbutzes in Israel, people who had come to this country from the occupied territories, from people who had witnessed Sabra and Shatila, the massacre there. I mean, listening to just about anyone I could listen to, and then all of a sudden it came clear that the Israeli government was treating the Palestinians in much the same way as the Hitler government treated the Jewish population prior to the use of trains to take people to the death camps. And when I came to that realization, it was horrifying to me. I mean, it was just horrifying that a people whose cause I had, in my little teeny inch of the universe, had always celebrated. I was a fan of the movie Exodus. I thought that was the real history of what happened with the establishment of the State of Israel. So, you know, and then the ensuing quarter century, after reading and paying attention, reading Israeli writers, Palestinian writers, Arab writers, Muslim writers, Jewish writers, American, blah, 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 blah. You know, until finally I just wanted to scream, why don't you people stop? You know, why can't you stop? So I know the feeling, Kay. Even now, I get this weird feeling when I bring up the topic, like, are you talking about something that you shouldn't be talking about? And when I get that feeling, I just kind of laugh.
I breathe.
For the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Bill in Paso Robles, California, and he is very kind in saying, Mike and Kathy, what you deliver night after night is immeasurable and priceless, deepest thanks. Bill in Paso Robles, California. Thanks, Bill. Regarding food insecurity, or people not being able to afford food, quick email from Bruce Enberg. He writes, not only do wages continue to decline and food constantly rise in price, although there was some downward pressure on food prior to the latest gas price spike, But also, food sources for the poor are drying up. Those who depend on food banks are finding as little as a quarter the amount of food that once was available. Relatives who might have been helping them in the past are now going hungry themselves. The increase in food stamps through the end of the Bush reign is not going as far as it did with rising prices. By the way, more people went on food stamps during the last 3 years of Bush than during the first 3 years of the so-called food stamp president, Obama. Median family income has fallen about $5,000 while everything else has gone up sharply. And the Occupy camps are being closed. That's a euphemism for being shut down by the authorities. Yeah, I got time here from Prairie 2. Bumper stickers. The Obama-Biden 2012 bumper sticker keeps getting longer. Among the Bush blunders reversed so far, Bin Laden dead, Iraq war over, GM number one again, North Korea nuke-free, North Korea needs the food badly, and a peace deal would give it the chance to really ramp itself up as the cheap labor factory floor for both China and South Korea. You could say that Obama is close to World War III with Iran, the corporate media says so, but there are rumors that just the opposite is true. Why would the axis of evil give up its nuclear, to quote George Bush, ambitions? Maybe they can deal with Obama and believe the Bush crime family is out of power permanently. Iran is being hurt pretty bad by the sanctions against its banks, but Obama has so far been unwilling to cut them off completely from the International Bank Clearinghouses, or Clearinghouse Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, or SWIFT, even though the banking hub has publicly agreed to do so in order to meet U.S. demands. Or more likely, the bankers, who are supposed to be non-political and neutral, are unwilling to back the U.S.'s play. If they do this, then China could demand the same be done against Taiwan. And China, unlike the U.S., is still a superpower. However, the United States is not declining quite as fast as previously thought, with fourth quarter GDP growth revised upward to 3%. This is respectable growth for a mature economy like the United States, mature in that it's dominated by old rich people who steal everything, at least where they can pull up the nails that are holding it to the floor. The stock market fell below 13,000 today on news that the Fed chairman doesn't believe more money printing is needed right now. The Dow doesn't really like good news, although Ben Bernanke did say unemployment would likely rise later in the year, and that did buoy Wall Street spirit somewhat. Job creation has actually been quite brisk, according to the households. Prairie 2 can get very sarcastic, can't he? Job creation has actually been quite brisk, according to the household survey, with the number of new jobs created on the order of 500,000 in two of the last 3 months. New February numbers will be out soon, and we'll be able to see if this is a real trend. Oil market analysts, the ones that don't work for Wall Street, are predicting that gasoline is more likely to be $3 by summer than $5. There's simply too much gasoline sloshing around. Supplies on hand are at record highs. Europe is slipping into recession on top of declining demand in the U.S., and this makes it almost a certainty that the speculation bubble will burst. That's the gasoline or oil speculation. But I hope the gas price goes way down so I can afford to drive something big enough to hold my Obama bumper sticker. PrairieNumeral2.com. He's an Obama supporter, in a manner of speaking. And also can be very sarcastic. I hate sarcasm, don't you? I mean, it just has no place on a radio show. All right, what do we got coming up? Oh, yeah, the WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks began publishing what it's referred to, not today, but 2 days ago, began publishing the Global Intelligence Files. That's more than 5 million emails from the Texas-headquartered so-called global intelligence company, Stratfor. I know you've been following this. Emails date from between July 2004 and late December just passed. They revealed the inner workings of a company, Stratfor, that fronts as an intelligence publisher, but actually provides confidential intelligence services to large corporations such as Bhopal India's Dow Chemical Company, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and government agencies, including Department of Homeland Security here, the United States Marines, and U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. The emails show Stratfor's web of informers, the payoff structure, payment laundering techniques, and psychological methods. And we'll cover some of that when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Very quickly, because this is February 29th, and here in the East, you got 2 hours left to do this, I guess. And I should have told you about this earlier. Tech News Daily reports that once Google's new unified privacy policy takes effect, all data already collected about you, including your search queries, your sites visited, your age, gender, location, all of this is going to be gathered and assigned to your online identity. After the policy takes effect, you are not allowed to opt out without abandoning Google altogether. But before the policy takes effect, you have the option of deleting your Google web history by modifying your settings so that Google is unable to associate data collected about you with your Gmail or YouTube accounts. Now, Sheila Samples at Op-Ed News sent this to me. And rather than going through the procedure, I would direct you to opednews.com, opednews.com. Just go to their main page and scroll down, go past the woman in the sexy white dress, if you can make it past her, and keep going until you see the Google flag logo in the middle of the page, not the middle, about a third of the way down, how to delete your Google browsing history before the new policy goes into effect March 1st. Okay. I guess on the West Coast, I guess that means you have until 3 o'clock in the morning Eastern time. I don't know. But anyway, you might want to consider this. Go to opednews.com, scroll down past the Israeli-Palestinian flags and the woman in the white dress, down, keep going. There you go, right there. How to delete your Google browsing history. It's right there with the Google logo flag graphic. So it might be, you know, I don't know if you want to do this or not. It's up to you. It's just that it's just astonishing. We are looking for a new bathroom sink for Molly's bathroom. a bathroom sink. Now, you know, the one we're looking for is around the $150, $200 price range, a bathroom sink. So Kathy went online, checking out Lowe's, Home Depot, Amazon, a few places. All of a sudden, over the past 2 weeks, thousands of ads about bathroom sinks. So, you know, it's a, you know what all this is about. You know what it's about. So you might want to take advantage. Go to opednews.com, scroll down, and you'll find it. How to change your history or get out of the way of this huge vacuum cleaner that's already been working, sucking up everything about you. Thanks to Sheila for sending that along. WikiLeaks. There's a company in Texas, a so-called global intelligence company called Stratfor, S-T-R-A-T-F-O-R. We've quoted them before. In my opinion, they're not a very nice organization whatsoever. But now WikiLeaks has released what is titled the Global Intelligence Files. That's more than 5 million emails from the Texas-headquartered company Stratfor. These emails cover a period of about 7 years. And as the press release from WikiLeaks a couple of days ago mentioned, the emails reveal the inner workings of a company that fronts as an intelligence publisher but actually provides confidential intelligence services to large corporations like Dow Chemical of Bhopal. You remember the Bhopal, India disaster? Do you remember that? Thousands of people died in their sleep. Only at the time, it wasn't Dow Chemical. It was, who was that, Kathy? Ah, damn. I should remember that forever, but slipping my mind. Somebody will post it for me. Anyway, Stratfor provides Union Carbide. They provide, thanks, Gigi Mommy, they provide all sorts of confidential capitalist corporate information to the people who pay for their services. And the emails that are being released show Stratfor's web of information, their payoff structure, their payment laundering techniques, and their psychological methods for that they employ. For example, here's one. Here's an email. Quote, "You have to take control of him. Control means financial, sexual, or psychological control. This is intended to start our conversation on your next phase." Now, that was signed CEO George Friedman to Stratfor analyst Reva Bala on 6 December 2011 on how to exploit an Israeli intelligence informant providing information on the medical condition of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. The material, the emails contains, according to the press release, privileged information about the U.S. government's attacks against Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and Stratfor's own attempts to subvert WikiLeaks. There are more than 4,000 emails mentioning WikiLeaks or Julian Assange. The emails also expose the revolving door that operates in private intelligence companies in the United States. Government and diplomatic sources from around the world give Stratfor advanced knowledge of global politics and events in exchange for money. The Global Intelligence Files exposes how Stratfor has recruited a global network of informants who are paid via Swiss bank accounts and prepaid credit cards. Stratfor has a mix of covert and overt information, which includes government employees, covert and overt informants, which includes government employees, embassy staff, and journalists around the world. The material shows how a private intelligence agency works and how they target individuals for their corporate and government clients. For example, Stratfor monitored and analyzed the online activities of Bhopal, India activists, including the Yes Men, whoever they are, for the U.S. chemical giant Dow Chemical. The activists seek redress for the 1984 Dow Chemical Union Carbide gas disaster in Bhopal, India. The disaster led to thousands of deaths, injuries in more than 500,000 people, and and permanent environmental damage. Stratfor has realized that its routine use of secret cash bribes to get information from insiders is risky. In August 2011, Stratfor CEO George Friedman confidentially told his employees, quote, "We are retaining a law firm to create a policy for Stratfor on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I don't want to do the perp walk, and I don't want anyone here doing it either," end quote. There's more. There's 5 million pages of this stuff, but there's a little bit more I want to share with you. I won't go that far, I promise. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Barely getting by. With millions in profits, it's just another lie. Hey, don't it make you red state? Hey, don't it make you red state? Hey, don't it make you red state blue?
He's in the jailhouse now.
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 Cuddle up, truth seekers. Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malloy.
WikiLeaks has begun publishing something referred to as the Global Intelligence Files, 5 million emails from the Texas-based company Stratfor, the so-called global intelligence company. And one of the more interesting ones is one that was signed by Stratfor CEO George Friedman. And he tells his employees that they have, this is back in August, we were retaining a law firm to create a policy for Stratfor on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I don't plan to do the perp walk, and I don't want anyone here doing it either. Talk about horse gone, lock, barn door, huh? Stratfor's, it says here, use of insiders for intelligence soon turned into a money-making scheme of questionable legality. The emails show that in 2009, then-Goldman Sachs managing director Shay Morenz and Stratfor CEO George Friedman hatched an idea to, quote, utilize the intelligence, end quote, it was pulling in from its insider network to start up a captive strategic investment fund. CEO George Friedman explained in a confidential August 2011 document marked "Do Not Share or Discuss," quote, "what StratCap will do is use our Stratfor's intelligence and analysis to trade in a range of geopolitical instruments, particularly government bonds, currencies, and the like," end quote. The emails show that in 2011, Goldman Sachs CEO Morenz, or managing director Morenz, quote, invested substantially, end quote, more than $4 million and joined Stratford's board of directors. Throughout 2011, a complex offshore share structure extending as far as South Africa was erected, designed to make StratCap appear to be legally independent. But confidentially, Friedman, the head of Stratford, told the staff, quote, do not think of StratCap as an outside organization. It will be integral. It would be useful to you if, for the sake of convenience, you think of it as another aspect of Stratford. Shea is another executive in Stratford. We're already working on mock portfolios and trades. And this company, StratCap, is due to launch this year, 2012. It goes on, the Stratford emails reveal a company that cultivates close ties with U.S. government agencies and employs former U.S. government staff. It is preparing the three-year forecast for the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, and it trains U.S. Marines and, quote, other government intelligence agencies, end quote, in, quote, becoming government Stratfors, end quote. Stratford's Vice President for Intelligence, Fred Burton, was formerly a special agent of the U.S. State Department's Diplomatic Security Service. Oh, for Christ's sake, I can't read any more of this garbage. It does say here, like WikiLeaks diplomatic cables, much of the significance of the emails will be revealed over the coming weeks as our coalition and the public search through them and discover connections. Readers will find that whereas large numbers of Stratford subscribers and clients work in the U.S. military and intelligence agencies, Stratford gave a complimentary membership to the controversial Pakistani General Hamid Ghul, former head of Pakistan's ISI intelligence service, who, according to U.S. diplomatic cables, planned an IED attack on international, read U.S., forces in Afghanistan in 2006. It just goes on and on. There's this, too. This is from an email. Burton at Stratford.com wrote, the emails show that pretty much that Pakistani military and intelligence members of the ISI were aware of bin Laden's presence in Abbottabad before he was killed in May of last year. Now, Pakistan denies that the country's officials and military were aware, but the emails show something entirely different. Oh, my God. You go, WikiLeaks. Just New York Times will probably, Washington Post. There are 25 media partners who are involved in publishing this stuff as it comes out from WikiLeaks. So, perhaps, not that this is going to bring any of these agencies or companies down, but I think it will expose them. This hour is being sponsored by Jerry in New York. That's all. Just Jerry in New York. He does get some cookies, though. Thanks, Jerry. In New York City, as a matter of fact. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's Mike Malloy.
Well, okay. Yeah, I really, really do. Phone lines are open if you want to join in, 877-996-2556. And this hour is being sponsored by Jerry in New York City on Avenue of the Americas. Thank you, Jerry. No message, just a sponsorship. Oh, and an address for the cookies. Did you send these to him? You did? They're already gone? If you have cookies coming, they're on the way. Or they have arrived, and you are scorfing them down as we speak. This is kind of interesting. There's a doctor in Texas, Jacques Roy. It turns out he's guilty of charges that he conspired to defraud Medicare and Medicaid of almost $375 million. That is if he turns out to be guilty. If he turns out to be guilty of that fraud, we'll know where some of the money went to a political action committee affiliated with the Tea Party Express, a group opposed to the health reform law that helped nab this guy. Between August 2009 and January 2010, Dr. Roy wrote five checks to Our Country Deserves Better PAC, associated with the Tea Party Express, according to the FEC. Roy also gave money to the Political Action Committee for the Texas Medical Association, which opposed the health reforms enacted in March of 2010 by the Democrats in Congress. Dr. Roy, who lives in Rockwell, Texas, gave the money during the most contentious months of the congressional debate over national health reform. His first donation was in August of 2009 when Tea Party activists and other opponents of the legislation stormed congressional town hall meetings. Remember that? And captured the attention of this corrupted, useless news media that we have. According to federal law enforcement agencies, Dr. Roy's financial support of Tea Party causes also took place in the middle of his nearly six-year-long campaign to steal from the government health programs. Federal agents arrested him and six others yesterday, alleging they worked together to file $350 million in bogus claims to Medicare and another $24 million in bogus claims to Medicaid. And a woman who shares a home and business address with Dr. Roy also donated money to the Republican National Committee. She was not charged in the Medicare and Medicaid fraud case. Spokespeople for the Tea Party Express, the Rockwell County Tea Party, the Dallas Tea Party, and the Rockwell County Republican Party, none of them responded to requests for comments to Huffington Post. Gee, I wonder why. Did I mention the phone lines are open? 877-996-2556 if you want to call in. The Department of Justice said Dr. Roy and his alleged co-conspirators charged taxpayers for home health care services that were either unnecessary or never provided. In some cases, giving patients cash, groceries, and food stamps in exchange for the cooperation. The indictment charges home health agency representatives recruited patients door-to-door and at locations including a homeless shelter and a church in Dallas. Can you imagine going into a church and saying, listen, we're running a scam here? Well, actually, they didn't say that, but they said, look, you let us file something on your behalf with Medicare and Medicaid, and we'll give you all this money. And the people in the church saying, ugh, where do I sign? Oh, God. Roy, who's 54 years old, he runs Metastat Group Associates in DeSoto, Texas. And according to this, worked with nearby home health agencies to produce the false claims. The owners of three home health agencies associated with all this were arrested also Tuesday. And because of their connections to Dr. Roy, 70 other agencies had their payments cut off by the government agency that administers Medicare and Medicaid. You see, if there's any reason why Medicare or Medicaid doesn't function the way it's supposed to, it's because of vermin like this son of a bitch. Okay, he's innocent until proven guilty. Alrighty. I will call him alleged son of a bitch then. How's that? An alleged con artist, an alleged thief, liar, cheat, you stinking bum. $375 million? You greedy bastard, you. You filthy, greedy bastard. And you know how much he contributed, at least they have records for, to the Tea Party Express? A stinking $1,650. He tries to steal hundreds of millions and then gooses the Tea Party with a stinking $1,600? I hope they find you guilty, Dr. Roy. Hope you lose your license. I hope you go to jail. Rat bastards. Federal agents said they raided Dr. Roy's home and office last June and seized what they claim is evidence he created a fake identity and is a flight risk, an illegitimate Texas driver's license, a Quebec identification card, and a Canadian birth certificate, all under the name of Michael Poulin, along with applications for a passport and Social Security benefits from Canada. Authorities also found books entitled Hide Your Assets and Disappear, a step-by-step guide to vanishing without a trace. You rotten bastard. Rotten, rotten bastard. Okay, Kevin, in Colorado Springs, hello.
You know, the best part about this is that the good doctor is going to get to experience government-run health care for the next 20, 30 years of his life, I'd say.
We can hope.
Yeah.
We can hope.
Oh, my gosh. It's unbelievable. I was listening to you talk about the WikiLeaks thing, and I was thinking to myself, how can anybody with a straight face anymore defend the releasing of these WikiLeaks documents? You remember how they were screaming about it's a national security concern.
Right, right.
Yeah, right. The only national security concern was you concerned about doing the perp walk.
And right.
It's just, I know there are things in the pipeline, but, you know, I can't wait till Occupy gets going again. Not that it has stopped.
It has been kind of dormant, and yeah. And I think it's going to hidden meaning here, but explode on the scene when warm weather comes back, because absolutely nothing has happened to stop this greed and this destruction of our economy and our political system. In fact, it's just accelerated. So the point was not made by the Occupy protests on the first go around. At least the point was not made to these rat bastards who continue to pillage, loot, burn, and steal. So it's going to have to come back, and it's going to come back, I think, in a tidal wave of resistance.
And, you know, the other day they had the story about the Occupy protesters that were arrested and supposedly got into this confrontation with the KKK.
Yeah.
And the media story that I saw on it, of course, complained about or told about the police getting caught in the middle of it and kind of insinuated that Occupy was responsible for it.
Right.
And that ties in with that caller you had last week that talked about being disappeared.
Yeah, really.
And I just want to say to all the Occupiers, don't forget what you have in your hand with that cell phone, with that picture camera, is very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And if everybody has one, it's almost impossible to hide that video, no matter how much they want to try. It's somehow going to get out.
That's true. Absolutely. Kevin, thank you. I appreciate you checking in, pal. John is in Chicago listening online. Hi, John.
Hey, Mike. You know, I hear you on the air, and you complain a lot about that you don't think there's enough government, right?
What? What are you talking about? You must have me confused with somebody else. Anyway, thanks, John. I'm complaining there's not enough government. What? We'll be right back.
And it's really elementary. Industrial Revolution has flipped the bitch on evolution. The benevolent wise are being thwarted out to size. What a bummer. The world keeps getting dumber. Insensitivity is standard, and faith is being fancied of reason. Totally going over in his coffin.
On the air, flying monkeys everywhere. I do not like them on my station. I do not like them in my nation. It's more Mike Malloy.
Oh, by the way, you know, I didn't even mention a thank you to Brad Friedman for filling in last night. Well, Kathy and I went to see a production of a Mother Goose thing. Molly goes to public school, as you know, and we are fortunate in that it's a public school with a very active parent body, very active PTA, and active not just in time and energy, but also resources. We, the people that have kids in the school, make sure that the best we can, either with time or energy or grants, that the school functions the way we want it to, and yet within the guidelines of the school system. But we have an incredible principal and incredible teachers. I've never seen a staff like this before, and I can't praise them enough. But they also have a woman who is the music teacher. They have art, they have music, and they have PE. And so many schools don't have that unless you go to a private school. This school is multiracial. It is, it's across the income spectrum. And we're just thrilled to have our kid in this school. So anyway, having said that, the music teacher put together a program for just the second graders to perform, and last night was the performance, and I have to tell you, it was just an absolute hoot. They had about 12 speaking parts, and then the Greek chorus, if you will, was probably another, what, Kathy, another, how many kids are in that second, the entire second grade in the school, about 150 second graders. So there were about 12, 15 speaking parts, and the rest of the kids were the, what I would call the Greek chorus. And Molly had one of the speaking parts. She was Chicken Little. And we had a couple of weeks here of Kathy making her costume and Molly learning her lines. And as she very patiently explained to me, Daddy, you have to learn the lines right before your lines, and so that you know what your cue is. And we had a rehearsal today, and we had to learn our blocking. Oh, man. You know, I spent about 5 years in theater here, and to have a 7-year-old, it just cracked me up. telling me about blocking and her lines and how she did. And she did great. All the kids did great. I mean, all the kids did just great. And so we got to go to see it, of course. And Brad Friedman kept the program live. So we didn't have to run a so-called best of, which really never is. Did I mention that this hour has been sponsored by Jerry in New York? Jerry on Avenue of the Americas. Ta-da. Oh, that's the address for the cookies. Thanks, Jerry. Very kind of you. Jeremy is in Burlington, Vermont, listening on Sirius. Hi, Jeremy.
Anyway, first off, I want to tell you that Molly Bumper is one of the best ones on all the shows out there.
Isn't that is so cool. Kathy wrote that, and she and Molly recorded it one night, and I didn't know it. And when I first heard that, I just about lost it.
I cracked up the first time I heard it back around Christmas time, so yeah.
Right.
But I read, I'm calling about Rick Santorum and his separation of church and state and how JFK makes him sick.
Oh, my God. What a thing to say.
I know, especially with Black History Month and all the stuff that's going on around the same time. He just keeps steeping to lower and lower lows. I'm truly waiting for him to hang himself with his own words. It's going to be coming soon.
Well, we don't have to worry about a President Santorum. And I have really appreciated this political season because I think it has allowed the Republican Party supporters, people who would otherwise call themselves Republicans, to see just how degenerate and sick and messed up their party has become. And I think it's going to cause a lot of them to either vote Democratic or to just withhold their votes and stay away from this garbage dump. But it's really been an education, I think, for the American public. And, you know, I'm always busting the mainstream media, but I'll tell you what. With 20 debates, all of which were televised, granted most of them on cable, but with all those debates, for mainstream media to force these bastards out into the daylight, so to speak, where they could be seen and heard, and not just them, but the audiences who would cheer executions and who would boo a veteran who happened, or an active combat soldier who happened to be gay. I mean, it's been a real education, I think, for most Americans to see what republicanism consists of.
Well, it was amazing that night that that soldier got booed because it was Rick Santorum who the question was directed to, and he wouldn't even say, hey, don't do that. He's fighting versus ghosts. He's gay or straight. It doesn't matter.
No, of course not.
He didn't even come close to backing this guy. He's like, well, whatever, skip right over it.
Yep. Well, you know, those are Republicans. Those are right-wingers, which is what the Republican Party has become. There is no conservative movement in this country right now. There is a right-wing movement that is not all that different from Italian or Spanish or German fascism. But that's what the Republican Party has sunk into. And you know what? They're proud of it, Jeremy.
Well, they're damn proud of it, but at least we're getting to see it in the public, and at least it makes them look like fools, and in the end it makes them worse and worse all the time.
That's right.
That's the only plus to it, I guess. Well, Mike, have a good night.
All right, Jeremy, thanks. Appreciate you checking in. Rick Santorum. This punk won't even be a footnote when the history of the 2012 political season is written. What a twit. All right, I know, it's Wednesday, we're supposed to be doing church night. We haven't really done any church night. Let me see what I've got here next hour. Do I have any church night coming up? Got some Keystone XL. Got something else that Sheila Samples sent. What else I got here? Oh, yes, I do. I have an open letter from a woman writing to liberal Catholics. Hold on for that one. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. Church night. Okay, yeah, we haven't done a lot of it yet so far this evening. It is, this is Wednesday, right? Oh, that's right. This is the first day after the first night after the chicken thing last night. Church night is, what we do occasionally on this program on Wednesdays in honor of a prayer meeting that certain evangelical Protestants do every Wednesday night. I guess they still do. I did when I was a kid, and I'd be the only child there with maybe 20 or 30 very fervently praying adults, among them my grandparents. So in not in honor of those moments, but rather as a method of exorcism, we do prayer night occasionally on this program on Wednesday nights. And in keeping with that tradition, I have for you this evening an open letter from a woman named Annie Laurie Gaylor. Annie Laurie Gaylor. It's an open letter to Catholics, and especially to liberal Catholics. You know who you are. You know who you are, liberal Catholic. Ma'am, sir, whatever. I got to share this with you. Open letter to liberal and nominal Roman Catholics. Not sure what that means, except if you go to the Latin root, nominal, name, and name only? Is that what it means? Okay, here you go. Dear liberal Catholic, it's time to quit the Roman Catholic Church. It's your moment of truth. Will it be reproductive freedom or back to the Dark Ages? Do you choose women and their rights or bishops and their wrongs? Whose side are you on anyway? It is time to make known your dissent from the Catholic Church in light of the U.S. Catholic Conference on Bishops of Bishops' ruthless campaign endangering the right to contraception. If you're part of the Catholic Church, you're part of the problem. Why are you propping up the pillars of a tyrannical and autocratic, woman-hating, sex-perverting, antediluvian old boys' club? Why are you aiding and abetting a church that has repeatedly and publicly announced a crusade to ban contraception, abortion, and sterilization, and to deny the right of all women everywhere, Catholic or not, the decision whether and when to become mothers? When it comes to reproductive freedom, the Roman Catholic Church is public enemy number one. Think of the acute misery, poverty, needless suffering, unwanted pregnancies, social evils, and deaths that can be laid directly at the door of the Catholic Church's antiquated doctrine that birth control is a sin and must be outlawed. A backer of the Roman Catholic presidential candidate... Which one, Annie Laurie? Says that if women want to avoid pregnancy, we should put an aspirin between our knees. Oh, that one. Catholic politicians are urging that the right to contraception should be left up to the states. Nearly 50 years after the Supreme Court upheld contraception as a privacy right, we're going to have to defend this basic freedom all over again? You're better than your church. So why? Why continue to attend Mass? Why do you tithe? Why dutifully sacrifice to send your children to parochial schools so they can be brainwashed into the next generation of... there's a word I've never seen. Myrmidons? M-Y-R-M-I-D-O-N-S? The next generation of Myrmidons? Okay, and potentially become the next church victims. For that matter, why have you put up with the institution that won't put up with women priests, that excludes half of humanity? No self-respecting feminist, civil libertarian, or progressive should cling to the Catholic faith. As a cafeteria Catholic, you chuck out the stale doctrine and moldy decrees of your religion, but keep patronizing the establishment that menaces public health by serving rotten offerings. Ooh, Annie Laurie. Your continuing Catholic membership as a so-called liberal casts a veneer of respectability upon an irrational sect determined to blow out the Enlightenment and threaten liberty for women worldwide. You are an enabler, and it's got to stop. If you imagine you can change the church from within, get it to lighten up on birth control, gay rights, marriage equality, embryonic stem cell research, etc., you are deluding yourself. If you remain a so-called good Catholic, you are doing bad to women's rights. You're kidding yourself if you think the church is ever going to add a doctrine of immaculate contraception. It is disgraceful that U.S. health care reform is being held hostage to the Catholic Church's bizarre opposition to medically prescribed contraception. No politician should jeopardize electability for failure to genuflect before the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Question to ask your bishop. Does he hold up an umbrella against the rain? Isn't that just as unnatural as using a condom or a diaphragm? Your church hysterically claims that secular medical policy is, quote, an assault against religious liberty, end quote. You are savvy enough to realize that the real assault is by the church against women's rights in health care. As nation columnist Katha Pollitt asks, is it an offense against Jehovah Witnesses that health care coverage will include blood transfusions? The Amish, as Pollitt points out, don't label cars an assault on religious liberty and try to force everyone to drive buggies. The louder the church cries, offense against religious liberty, the harder it works to take away women's liberty. Obama has compromised, but the church never budges, instead launching a vengeful modern-day inquisition. Look at its continuing directives to parish priests to use their pulpits every Sunday to lobby you against Obama's policy. The church's announcements of a major anti-contraception media campaign using your tithes and contributions and donations to defeat Obama's laudable health care policy. The church has introduced into Congress the Respect for Rights of Conscience Act. Respect for Rights of Conscience Act. A bill to place the conscienceless, the conscienceless Catholic Church's rights of conscience above the rights of conscience of 53% of Americans. Now, that's a tough sentence right there. That's a tough one. That the church has so-called conscience rights to deny women their rights is a kissing cousin to the claim that, quote, corporations are people, end quote. The church that hasn't persuaded you to oppose contraception now wants to use the force of secular law to deny contraceptive rights to non-Catholics. But is there any point in going on? After all, your misplaced loyalty has lasted through two decades of public sex scandals involving praying, P-R-E-Y, praying priests, children you may have known as victims, and church complicity, collusion, and cover-up going all the way to the top. Are you like the battered woman who, after being beaten down every Sunday, feels she has no place else to go? But we have a more welcoming home to offer, free of incense-fogged ritual, free of what freethinker Bertrand Russell called ideas uttered long ago by ignorant men, free of blind obedience to an illusory religious authority. Join those of us who put humanity above dogma. Very truly, Annie Lawyer Laurie Gaylor, co-president, Freedom from Religion Foundation. Hallelujah.
Well, you better listen, my sisters and brothers, 'cause if you do, you can hear their voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will till we all come to.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour, and as everybody knows by now, Olympia Snow, one of the two senators, senators who are women, and both of whom are from Maine, Senator Olympia Snow, three-time Republican senator, plus she served in the U.S. House, she said yesterday that she's had enough, will not run for re-election this November. And she cites excessive partisanship and what she calls dispiriting political environment. The Senate. Yeah, okay, I get that. Now, the way it's being framed is this is a potential blow to Republicans who need just a handful of seats to regain control of the Senate. No, I'm afraid not. This November will be a real test, truth seekers, to see... I know the rush to fascism, Christo-fascism, and the drip, drip, drip of the slow move to corporatism. I realize what the two choices are here. I really do. But this November's elections, where every House member, a third of the Senate, and the presidency is all up for are all up for grabs, we will see if the American people finally, because it could not be clearer this time. If the American people want a rush to fascism or a slower move to corporatism, now, arguably, they're both the same. One of them is a rush. The other one is a slow movement in that direction. The idea being, if you want to get politically real, is on a slow train, you have more of a chance of derailing the damn thing than on a rocket ship, for example. So if you want a rocket ship to fascism, vote Republican. If you want a slow train to corporatism with the possible chance of derailing it, you might consider voting Democratic. If you've had enough, then you can either opt out completely or find yourself a third-party candidate or in the states where it's allowed, write in someone's name. Olympia Snow... says no. That's it. She's had enough. She said in her statement, after 33 years in the Congress, this was not an easy decision. She served 16 years in the House, by the way, before moving to the Senate. She said, my husband and I are in good health. We have laid an exceptionally strong foundation for the campaign, and I have no doubt I would have won re-election. But, I do find it frustrating that an atmosphere of polarization and, quote, my way or the highway, end quote, ideologies have become pervasive in campaigns and in our governing institutions. Now, without saying it, you know who she's referring to. She's referring to her nominal colleagues, other Republicans, because the Democrats don't do that. Democrats are like pieces of overly boiled ramen noodles, you know, they just kind of, you know, there's no stiffening of the spine of Republicans. And the lead piece of spaghetti is, of course, Barack Obama. So Olympia Snow is not, unless she is a total moron, which she isn't, she's not referring to Democrats. All you have to do with a Democrat is just, I don't know, a Democrat says, well, I'm not going to do that. And the Republican whips out a Bible and a flag and says, I'll go tell on you if you don't. And the Democrat immediately goes, okay. I'm not against the flag. I'm not against the Bible. Okay. Where do I sign? What do I do? Don't waterboard me. What? Right? You know that's true. So Olympia Snow is talking about Republicans. She added, quote, unfortunately, I do not realistically expect the partisanship of recent years in the Senate to change over the short term. So at this stage of my tenure in public service, I have concluded that I am not prepared to commit myself to an additional 6 years in the Senate, which is what a fourth term would entail, end quote. So the Democrats now are scrambling to see if they can field a candidate in Maine that has, by the way, a teabagger governor. Whether or not the Democrats can find someone who will run for Olympia Snow's now or soon to be vacancy. Other than a couple of specific issues, I always thought Olympia Snow and Susan Collins were quite good Republicans. I really did, you know? We'll be right back. And some further information about another Barack Obama betrayal. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Past the reefs of green, through the squalls of deep. Sail on. Sail on. Sail on. Sail on. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'll need the left or right. I'm
7 out of
Show. Talk radio matters here.
Twenty-five before the hour. So what did I say a minute ago? Another betrayal by Barack Obama? I don't know. It's just, I know that that just makes Obama supporters so angry. Betrayal, not the right term, Malloy. Strategic move, strategic withdrawal, rope-a-dope, but never betrayal. Well, I strongly disagree. Obama once again facing, McClatchy Newspapers calls it facing fire from Republicans over the rising cost of gasoline. You know, why doesn't this president step out and say, look, you crazy bastards. Okay, he didn't have to say bastards. He said, you crazy freaks. You think I'm responsible for the uptick in the pricing? Oh, what am I doing to cause it to go up? And push the issue. We haven't opened a new gasoline refinery in this country in, what, 40 years? Because we don't need one. We're exporting gasoline. Refining capacity is where it, exactly where it should be. Where's the money going? It's going into the pockets of the speculators and the gamblers and the Wall Street casino owners. That's where it's going. But Obama doesn't do that, does he? I don't understand that. I really don't. So anyway, we'll use that as a starting point. Obama refuses to push back in a way that let's the American people know the truth. And if you're not going to tell the truth, what the hell good are you? Seriously. So in order to offset the fire coming from Republicans, on Monday, the Obama administration moved quickly, McClatchy says, to trumpet a Canadian company's decision to build a section of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline from Cushing, Oklahoma, to Houston, Texas, after the president blocked a longer path last month. Do you get that? The White House trumpets. It sounds so Roman Empire, doesn't it? Trumpets a decision by the TransCanada to go ahead and build this a section of the pipeline. Press Secretary Jay Carney said this decision by TransCanada should counter Republican criticism that his boss, Barack Obama, has stifled oil and gas production. Jay Carney said the Oklahoma to Texas section of the pipeline would, quote, help address the bottleneck of oil in Cushing, Oklahoma, that has resulted in large part from increased domestic oil production currently at an eight-year high, end quote. Do you get that part? Domestic oil production currently at an eight-year high, and yet gasoline prices continue to go up. Well, it must be that Muslim in the White House. It's got to be his fault. That Kenyan. That not American. And so what does the not American do? Oh, okay, well, we're going to cheer the fact that a piece of the pipeline is being built. This is obscene. This is why I cannot and will not and do not support Barack Obama. It's this kind of stuff. Are you kidding me? Are you crazy? You're still okay. Never mind. Anyway, according to Jay Carney, a spokesman for Barack Obama, TransCanada's decision, quote, highlights a little-known fact. This is Jay Carney speaking. It highlights a little-known fact. Certainly you wouldn't hear it from some of our critics that we approve. Pipelines are approved and built in this country all the time. End quote. You see? Now, of course, in the right wing, the crazies, that is every Republican who is now a right winger, they constantly scream that Obama is stopping all this, that Obama is being held hostage by those dirty, vicious, gnashing, bloodthirsty environmentalists. Oh, you dirty, rotten environmentalists. When the truth is none of that. None of that is happening. But Republicans, the extreme right wing in this country, are insane. They are collectively mad, so they continue to wallow in their insanity and expect that everyone else is going to listen to it. So, McClatchy says, Obama's decision last month to reject the full 1,661-mile Keystone XL pipeline from Canada's tar sands has become a focal point of Republican efforts to portray him as responsible for the recent spike in gasoline prices. And you know what, Truth Seekers? The Republicans are dumber than dog crap, but their constituents are even stupider. How does somebody out there in middle America really believe that Barack Obama is responsible for the spike in gasoline prices? How do you do that unless you are just a blind, frothing at the mouth, brain dead, racist piglet who lives in America in your little white enclave, which is soon going to disappear? And you're willing to believe anything that a Santorum or a Romney or a Gingrich or the rest of these freaks tell you. How can you be this stupid? You think that, what does Barack Obama do? Does he sit in his little secret room inside the White House and he says, I think I'm going to make gasoline prices go up another dime this week. Oh boy, this is fun. Yes, that's what they think. And yes, that's what the Republican establishment tries to make them think. And they're very successful. After all, if you have a Kenyan in the White House who is a Muslim and not a Bible-believing, God-fearing Christian, anything is possible and probable and certain. Barack Obama's responsible. So, buying into that meme, Jay Carney comes out and says, see, we're not responsible. We're building sections of the pipe. Well, we're not, but, well, you might as well say we are, but I don't know. Something's true here. Something's not. TransCanada's building a section of the pipeline. See, we're not what the Republicans say we are. See, we're not environmental wackos. We don't give a goddamn if you can't breathe 10 years from now. We don't care. Wow. The right wing faults Obama for blocking this project that they say would create jobs and reduce America's dependence on oil imports from unstable foreign sources. How many times do people have to be told? Well, don't even ask that question, Malloy. The fact is that very little, if any, of this vile poison that's going to be extracted from this horrific tar sands hole in the ground, that when this stuff finally is refined into the gloppy, black, poisonous junk that it will be, it's not going to be used here anyway. You try to tell that to the average American right-winger, and they just look at you and eat another booger. What are you talking about? Is it time to go to church? Oh, my God. No, you don't believe that? A recent national survey by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. The survey suggests that Obama's Keystone decision could become a political liability. Could become. 37% of those surveyed said they had not heard of the pipeline. That's one out of three haven't even heard of it. However, of those who had heard of it, 66% said the government should approve it, with just 23% opposed. 66%. Now, what does that tell you? Does it tell you that those comments were made, those 66% are, those comments are coming from people who are highly informed about the nature of the so-called gasoline crisis in this country? Is that decision coming from people who are fully aware of the environmental death that's just waiting, as a matter of fact, is already stalking the landscape? Or is that decision among the, or that agreement among 66%, is just about exactly two-thirds of those who know about the pipeline say, yes, yes, we want the pipeline. Is that decision coming from a place of utter and absolute ignorance? I won't say stupidity. I'll just say ignorance. What do you think, Truth Seeker? Huh? What do you think? In fact, energy experts say that the Keystone XL pipeline won't do much to lower gasoline prices. The recent price spike stems largely, of course, from speculators bidding up the price. That's all. That's all. Now, TransCanada will be the second pipeline moving oil from Cushing, Oklahoma to the Gulf Coast. The other's already built, owned by a company called Enbridge Inc. The two pipelines will reduce the glut of oil in the Midwest, and in doing so, will raise the price of oil in Cushing and the Midwest, and will lower the price very slightly in the rest of the world. So, you people who live in the Midwest, go ahead, cheer for the pipeline. And when it's finally built and working, the price of your gasoline and your heating oil is going to go even higher.
Get our hands on that greasy, slimy stuff.
Before the hour. So, now folks, Bill McKibben and other people have been talking about the environmental craziness of all this. And the fact that building this pipeline and digging out the tar sands to extract the oil and the refining process and the use of this stuff is a death warrant for the planet. No, nobody's listening. It's just, I can't believe this. You know, it's a death warrant. It's just an absolute death warrant. So since nobody listens to that, what they listen to is the jingle jangle of coin in their pocket. You folks in the Midwest, according to the experts, as reported here by McClatchy Newspapers, prices in the Midwest for gasoline could go up as much as 10 to 30 cents a gallon, which will end that region of the country's cheaper gasoline compared to other areas. And if the full pipeline is, that's just with the construction of this piece going from Cushing, Oklahoma to Houston. The piece that Jay Carney and the Obama administration are going, yeah, see, we're not wimps. You know, that piece of cooked spaghetti, right? Instead of just standing right up and telling the American public why gasoline is up. Anyway, if the full pipeline is constructed, the impact on world oil prices would, quote, never really be noticed, end quote. That's according to Severin Borenstein, a professor at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. So the price will go up in the Midwest, and the price will lower very slightly in the rest of the world. The price of, for oil, the price of gasoline in the Midwest to go from 10 to 30 cents up. And the impact on world oil prices, if the full pipeline is constructed, would never really be noticed because it would be so small, a few cents or less per gallon, that it would be, quote, lost in the noise of other charges, end quote. So who benefits then, damn it? If the world oil market doesn't benefit, if the American consumer doesn't benefit, who benefits? That's right. The capitalist speculators. The ones who are destroying your home. The ones who are destroying your air, your water, your children's genetic structure. And you don't give a goddamn. You just don't care. You don't care. Kill my children. Kill my grandchildren. Make them deformed mentally and spiritually and physically. I don't care. What is wrong here? Oh, don't start. Don't start, Malloy. This is church night. If this is really bothering you, then when the program's over, do what your grandma used to tell you. Go into your closet and pray. TransCanada also told the Barack Obama State Department 2 days ago that it, TransCanada, plans to submit a new application for the rejected segment of the pipeline. And Jay Carney, Mr. Obama's mouthpiece, said Obama's rejection last month, quote, in no way prejudged future applications, end quote. So in other words, Jay is saying, of course, TransCanada, bring it on. We just did that to give the illusion to our environmental supporters that we are resisting the Republican pressure to go ahead and hurry up and finish the death struggle of the planet. We're just pretending here. Go ahead, you know, we're no way prejudiced to future applications. Now, of course, Obama maintains, and Jay Carney is willing to spew out there, that it was the Republicans in government that forced Barack Obama to reject the earlier application because the Republicans didn't give it enough time. It didn't give the Obama administration enough time, the State Department, the Environmental Protection Agency, enough time to review the project. Oh, stop it, for Christ's sake. This is what the Obama administration says. Well, it's not our fault. We didn't really want to stop it. And they're assuming that all the environmentalists now have their fingers in their ears. The little sop that was thrown to the environmentalists was, well, we're going to stop this project, the Obama administration said a couple of months ago. We're going to stop it. Oh, yay, 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 all the environmentalists said. Well, the ones that, you know, are weakened environmentalists, the real ones said, uh-oh, oh, Jesus, he's doing it again. Obama's doing it again. He's making it sound as though he's going to fulfill one of his rock-bottom promises, and he's not. So, the Republicans made me do it. Now, the Republicans, as squirrely and as insane as these right-wingers are, they accuse Obama of putting off the decision until after the 2012 election so as not to upset those commies that support him. You know, the environmentalists, those dirty, filthy, goddamn socialist commie rat bastards who want clean air, clean water, decent earth, healthy food. You know who I'm talking about, right? So according to Republicans, Obama just is putting it off till after the elections to appease them. Well, Republicans, what do you care then? Oh, that's right, the re-election thing. Oh, I see. I get it. Okay. Now, environmental groups, of course, have referred to this as a disaster and called the Obama administration's welcome of TransCanada's plan, quote, an alarming about-face, end quote. I would suggest to my environmentalist brethren and sistern that this is not an about-face at all. Are you kidding me? This is just more of President Barack Obama. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.